It's Maria.
And this is Jordan. Welcome back to Major Musings.
Yay. How you doing, Jordan?
I'm already... already don't know how to answer. No. I'm doing good. I was working today, so I...
Nice.
Yeah, how's it going for you?
Pretty good. I mean, I did see you this past weekend.
Yeah, that was exciting. Came and visited St. Pete.
Yeah, always wonderful. Went to the Dali Museum, saw the Van Gogh exhibit.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah, it was
and,
nice
you know, I mean, I guess I got to see you too, but like...
Oh, whatever. Yeah, of course.
all right, so yeah, I hope everyone enjoyed our previous episode on Salvador Dasguer. Taking a bit of a shift today, Jordan's taking over with talking about Robert Smithson. So I'm going to let her take it away now.
Thanks. Yeah, Robert Smithson is probably one of my favorite artists, at least right now. He was a land artist working in the mid to late 60s up until the early 70s. And I think I first learned about him definitely in my freshman year at UF when I took late 20th century art history. I want to say that his work, Spiral Jetty, is included in AP art history that you would take in high school, but I don't specifically remember learning about him then. I definitely remember just being at UF and learning about his work and being like, wow, this is wild. It's so cool. I was just kind of overwhelmed by the fact that someone could make something like that, and it was art and important, and that you could go visit it. And so since then I've been really interested in him and in land art specifically. So he was born on January 2nd, 1938. So his birthday was just a little bit ago. Yeah. And he was born in Passaic, New Jersey.
Okay.
He unfortunately died in a plane crash when he was only 35.
Oh my God.
I know that. Yeah, it's really tragic. He was actually surveying a site for a future work. And yeah,
plane... Oh, you're kidding me.
No, I know. The plane crashed in, I believe it was outside Amarillo, Texas. So...
That is tragic.
Yeah, it really is sad. And his wife, Nancy Holt, was also an artist in her own right, who also did a lot of land art and earthworks. And so she and... another artist who I'm forgetting the name of, but they kind of finished that last piece that he didn't get a chance to finish after he died. Yeah. That's sweet. Yeah. And so Nancy Holt did a lot of cool stuff as well. So before Smithson worked in the land and the earth, he actually started out his career as a painter.
Oh.
Yeah, but kind of even from that early time, he was very interested in the natural world, geology, other forms of art like literature and science fiction novels. And so this vein of interest in the scientific runs throughout kind of his whole career. And he, I believe in the 60s, he kind of left the art world for a while and then returned and moved from painting into sculpture and three-dimensional works. And so this especially is when he really started to bring these questions of science, nature, geology, some of these other disciplines back into his own artistic practices and the things he was investigating.
So when he took that break from the art world, did you find out what he did, or is there no information on that?
Because
I'm wondering what sparked that shift from painting to.
Yeah, so I'm trying to remember because I do remember reading about this, and I'm looking my notes real quick. So I actually am not entirely sure what he did in that brief time. But I will say that when he came back into the art world, it was in the mid-60s when the minimalism movement was kind of in its prime.
Right.
So for those who maybe are not as familiar with minimalism, the art movement, not this like recent movement where you might think of the minimalist or Marie Kondo. The minimalism art movement was looking to break down traditional notions of sculpture and to erase distinctions between painting and sculpture, while also usually trying to remove the artist's hand from the work as well. So some of the figures with this is Donald Judd, Carl Andre, Dan Flavin. Those are some of the big guys who were working in minimalism. And there were women minimalists, but those three guys are kind of like the ones who generally get mentioned. But I just want to say that there were women minimalists.
Of course.
Yeah. But yeah, no, so when Smithson comes back to the art world, this is the thing that is kind of the newest interest.
So he kind of follows the trend.
Yeah, so it's interesting because his works aren't, they're not in reaction necessarily to these ideas, but more of just in response to what was happening. So Smithson was concerned with the idea of reconceiving what the art object means, so what it could be and how it was interpreted in a museum or a gallery setting versus how one would experience an art object outside of the museum setting as well. Mm-hmm. So then what does it mean to have an object in nature or to use the natural world as part of your art itself? So some things, you know, that artists of the earlier 20th century had been investigating, but he really was just more explicit in his use of the natural environment and the natural matter. And so kind of taking some questions from minimalism, especially also with how the viewer was meant to interact with the work and with the space itself, and then just not updating it, but just asking other questions related to the environment that someone like Carl Andre maybe wasn't exactly asking.
Right.
So along with the actual sculpture and the art objects themselves, Smithson was also an avid writer. I mentioned earlier that he was interested in science fiction novels as well as other art historical and anthropological writings, and he often would write essays that would accompany his works. And yeah, so he would either publish them himself or include them to be published in somewhere like Art Forum, which is a large and important art and art criticism magazine or journal.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
Yeah, it's really, really great because, you know, a lot of times artists are so ambiguous with what their art means or what they're trying to say about certain things. And so when you have someone like Smithson, or then another artist that I immediately think of is Van Gogh, who just writes so much, you really get a different sense of who they are as a person and what they're trying to say and do with their art. Yeah,
they just put it all out there.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like reading Smithson's works, you can really tell that he does value literature and writing as an art form itself. Mm-hmm. And I believe he's mentioned that he is interested in like language and semantics, but but yeah, I haven't looked like super deep into that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have like a little fun fact, I guess you could say. So Smithson was born in Passaic, New Jersey, and there is a doctor who is also a poet called William Carlos Williams, and he was the doctor who I think delivered Smithson and then was his pediatrician or something.
What?
I know, it's so random. So you just have this like this weird little connection to like modernist poetry from him being born in New Jersey. Yeah.
From the doctor who birthed him.
Yeah, yeah. So just, yeah, just a fun little tidbit.
There you go. We're all engaging in some form of creative expression deep down.
Yeah, exactly.
Even the scientists.
Oh, yeah. But so one example of some of Smithson's rich writing is when he wrote his essay to accompany his idea of non-sites, which I believe I mentioned this when I was talking about Nkanga, his idea of the non-site. And so his essay is called A Provisional Theory of Non-Sites. And so he defines what a non-site is. And he wrote, quote, "The non-site, or an indoor earthwork, is a three-dimensional logical picture that is abstract, yet it represents an actual site. It is by this three-dimensional metaphor that one can represent another site which does not resemble it, thus the non-site."
That's complex.
Yes. I know a lot of his work, or his writings, are kind of like that, where you're like, oh, geez, I might have to read this like one or two more times to really understand what he was saying.
So could you break that down for the listeners?
Yeah, yeah. So the non-site that I mentioned with Nkanga's episode deals with the Ruhr Valley in Germany. And so I'm just going to use that example again. But he also did other non-sites, like four sites in New Jersey or other places in the U.S. But so he took earth or rocks or sediment, whatever the specific natural matter was, and he brought it into the museum setting, and he arranged it in a certain configuration. Sometimes they're in almost like shelves of sorts that are hollow, where you can see the rocks coming out, or they're in not boxes because they're different shapes, but we can post a picture on Instagram so I can so you can see what I am trying to describe better. But
major underscore musings, folks.
Yes. And then usually he would also include some sort of like photograph or a map or some sort of topographical reference to the site as well. So it was about, he was representing a specific place inside the museum, but it could never actually be that place because we were in the museum setting. We were not in the Ruhr Valley in Germany itself, even though the rocks or the dirt was from there. So it became this sort of non-site. So originating in the place, but not actually the place itself. So I think that's what he means by it's a metaphor.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. And so another work that he did in the land itself was the Yucatan mirror displacements. And we have a picture of this on our Instagram as well. And I really love this piece. I think it's really interesting. So for it, he traveled to the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. And he visited a number of different topographical sites, such as different beaches along the Gulf of Mexico, a jungle, and a charred site, which is, I'm not entirely sure what that means, but that's what he calls it in his own terms. Okay. And in these,
we'll take his word for it.
Yeah. In these different sites, he placed square mirrors into the landscape so that they became almost part of the land itself.
Oh.
Yeah, so the mirrors are part of the art object, but their insertion into the land also renders the land and the natural matter a part of the art as well. So the mirrors are both reflecting and obscuring the landscape in this interesting duality.
Right. And I'm looking at the photo right now that we posted, and for reference for everyone, it's the first series of posts on Robert Smithson, and it's the last photo. So there's nine of them, so in different places in the land?
Yes.
Okay.
And so for this one, he also wrote an essay that accompanied it, and it was published in Art Forum, like I had mentioned earlier, and he called it incidence of mirror travel in the Yucatan, which is really interesting because that is a direct reference to a book that was written in the mid-19th century called Incidence of Travel in Yucatan.
Oh.
Yeah, which is by John L. Stevens. And Maria and I actually took a modern Latin American art history class together our senior year. And so you might be slightly familiar with this, Maria, because I think we briefly touched on Stevens and his travel partner, Frederick Catherwood, who did drawings of the Yucatan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, I remember now. For a second, I thought, oh, God, she's mentioning this, and I don't remember it at all. No, I remember this. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That was interesting to learn about.
Yeah, and so Smithson was familiar with this book, and he directly refers to that title.
Yeah.
And in that book, Catherwood, who was the illustrator, depicted the Mayan architecture ruins and other objects that remained there. And I believe he even included indigenous peoples. Not sure if they were actual people he came in contact with or if he was kind of imagining the Mayans as they lived there. But nevertheless, he includes all of these things. And in Smithson's essay, he references the Mayans, but he does not actually include any of the Mayan ruins in the photographs that were associated with the mirror displacements.
Mm-hmm.
If you look in the image that shows all 9 of the photographs, you'll notice that it really is only the land and the different topographies and then the mirrors. Some of them are easier to see than others. Some of them are really obscured by the land.
Yeah, I was going to say, and some of them I couldn't even tell for a second until I squinted and, you know, actually zoomed in.
Yeah, it's very interesting how he's placed them. It really does obscure the landscape, but then also reflect what's around it as well.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because, you know, like you said, that he kind of went back into the art scene as minimalism was on the rise. And it does make sense when you look at these because, sure, he's the one who placed the mirrors, but he had no control over what the effect would look like. It was really the landscape that was in full control. And you can see that by how some are very obvious or some are hardly even visible.
Yes. And that is a very good observation to note because...
Thank you.
because this interest in kind of letting nature take its course definitely comes back into play in Spiral Jetty. So I'll touch on that. I'll touch on that soon.
Perfect.
But with the mirror displacements, I actually talked about them in a project that I did for that Latin American art class where it was a group project where we had to pretend to curate an exhibit. Maria, you probably remember this. My group.
I was not in your group. No.
I know, but but my group was interested in looking at how identity, specifically through a Latin American lens, but how identity can be created through the land and through one's own environment. And so I was looking at how Smithson, as an American man, went into Mexico and created these mirror displacements. And for that project, I wrote, you know, we can question Smithson's intrusion into the Yucatan and ask, how is he engaging with this landscape? Is he trying to create an identity? I don't know.
I don't know.
And, you know, for the purposes of that exhibit or that project, I think it was an important question to ask. But in the broad scheme of things, I don't know if... I don't necessarily think he was trying to create any sort of identity with the land.
Right.
You know, in the past or even in the present still, artists do try to create identities and relationships with the land, you know, similar to maybe what I was speaking about with Nkanga, or then scholars have tried to link artists to the land. there's an interesting history of linking female artists and feminism to the land, which could be a future episode maybe. But I don't think Smithson was necessarily trying to do that, and so I don't want I don't want to try to call him out for something that I don't think he was purposefully, you know, not thinking about or being careless about, or, you know, as this Westerner coming into a quote-unquote non-Western land. But
yeah, well,
but it is an interesting thing to think about, though.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about artists from that time period, specifically, you know, the white male in the art scene at the time, there's really only so much that you can expect from them in terms of what they discuss. So I think that in aspects like this, what's important is recognizing that as you discuss their history and their career, but also, you know, it was, unfortunately, it was part of the time to just go to these areas and not fully take into consideration the identity of it so much. So.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's even, that has been a criticism of the land art movement from more contemporary scholars of, you know, it's a predominantly male-dominated movement. You think of some of the big artists like Robert Smithson, and then others like Michael Heiser or Walter de Maria, who went into these lands who, you know, previously were inhabited by indigenous peoples, whether that's in the Yucatan or in the American West, where Native Americans were, you know, driven out in the 17 and 1800s. And especially with someone like Heiser, who just extracted the land and moved so much of it for his art. And so, you know, just, so that has been a criticism of, of land art. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. And they're all, I mean, like minimalism, there were female land artists as well, and just they just don't get talked about as much. But I think
shocking.
Recently, though, I have seen some articles online where they're like, "Oh, look at all of these women artists who were not Heiser, Smithson, or De Maria, or these other people." So, you know, trying to bring light to them. Like, so focusing on someone like Nancy Holt, who, you know, was married to Smithson, but also did a lot of really interesting and cool stuff on her own as well.
Yeah.
But, so in The Mirror Displacements, Smithson is exploring the themes and ideas that are running throughout his other works. This question of the art object in nature, also ideas of temporality and how art can intervene with time as well as with the natural environment. And so with that, I'm going to segue into Spiral Jetty.
Okay.
Because that's his big one, or one of the big ones, and there's a lot to talk about, and also I'm just a big fan.
You're just a big fan of it, yeah.
Yeah. I really love it, and it's like the top of my bucket list to go out to Utah and to see Spiral Jetty in person. So,
wow. I didn't know it was still there.
Oh, yes. So he created Spiral Jetty in 1970, and throughout its 50 years. That's crazy. 50-year history. Wow. Yeah. It was underwater for a large part of that, and then I believe it was the early 2000s. It resurfaced, but that is because there was a drought in Utah.
Climate change doesn't exist. What are you talking about?
No, of course not. You know, it would be really interesting to see what Smithson would have to say about how Spiral Jetty has changed throughout the years. He would probably, he probably would be very fascinated with the fact that it was underwater for so long and that it has now reappeared. But I'm going to touch on some of this a bit later. But so Spiral Jetty is an earthwork. So it is, calling it a sculpture feels wrong. It really is an earthwork. Like it's an artwork that is made of the earth and exists in the earth.
Right.
It literally is made of basalt boulders that Smithson had placed in a spiral-like formation into the Great Salt Lake, which is in Utah. And it is also a film. So I'll talk about some of the actual earthwork itself, and then I'll touch on the film as well. Mm-hmm. So the actual earthwork is 1,500 feet long.
Oh my God.
Which, yeah, when I read that, it kind of blew my mind because, I mean, I obviously have not been there and have only seen pictures. And so I would assume that it's hard to really get the full scale of it until you go. But the 1,500 feet, I think also is, you know, taking into account that it does spiral. So it doesn't go strictly 1,500 feet out. And then the spiral itself is about 15 feet wide. So it extends from the shore of the lake into the Great Salt Lake, and it goes counterclockwise in its spiral. And he used about 7,000 tons of locally sourced basalt boulders.
My God.
I know.
So not much.
No, not at all. just 7,000 tons to form the spiral.
That's fine.
Yeah. And then Smithson chose this site specifically because it is in close proximity to nearby abandoned oil rigs of Rosal Point, and also the close by Golden Spike Monument, which marked the 1869 completion of the Transcontinental Railway.
Ah.
Yeah, so there's some interesting, I guess you could say maybe industrial history associated with this site. And then he was also fascinated by the Great Salt Lake itself. And if you look in pictures, which I believe you can see it in the picture we included on Instagram, the water itself is a really amazing color. So it's almost pink in some areas because there's a red algae in it. And and so he was fascinated by this color.
I didn't even think that was water.
Oh yeah, that's the lake.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's red algae in it, and then along with salt crystals, of course, since it's called the Great Salt Lake.
Mm-hmm. And we had a listener ask, her name's Rhea, we had her ask why it is in the shape of a spiral. So is there a reason for that?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So I think the reason probably is that Smithson was very interested, like I said, in the natural world and geology and entropy and with crystals specifically. And crystals actually, when they form, they form in either clockwise or counterclockwise spirals. So the spiral is a very it's a very interesting shape because it appears a lot in like mythologies and kind of the like human fabricated histories. And then also it's a very natural form as well. So if you think about like the shell or the inner ear, if you've ever seen a diagram, and I believe Smithson drew some, he has a lot of interesting drawings that he made when planning for his earthworks. So we can include some of that on our Instagram posts for the future as well, so you can see it.
Yeah.
But so the spiral is a really interesting shape because of that, because of its kind of mythic status, I'd say, as this transcendent almost shape of nature and of history. So
interesting.
Yeah. And so then, like I said, he was also very interested in crystallization and in entropy and in other processes of the natural world. And so with the spiral jetty, he actually requested, or he specified, that he did not want any preservation work to be done on the jetty.
Okay.
Yeah, he wanted it to eventually crystallize, and he wanted all those basalt rocks to just let nature take its course and for it to develop and change forms throughout its own life. So he wanted the spiral jetty to continue to spiral in on itself almost through the crystallization of the salt on the rocks. So
have there been like photographs taken of it as it's changed over time?
Yeah, I believe so. I feel like online, there's probably some way to see the different the different aerial shots of the jetty throughout the years, especially like when it was submerged and you couldn't really see it that well. So I'll try to find that, and we can include it on our link of the link of the sources that's in our link tree, so that so that other people can see that, because
definitely
because it is interesting since it does continue to change. And I believe the Dia Art Foundation is the one who technically like owns the rights to it now, so they're the ones who maintain it.
Okay.
But also that's very much like an air quotes maintain, because they don't like they don't really do anything with it, because Smithson didn't want them to.
They just let it run its course.
Yeah.
Perhaps prevent anyone from vandalizing it.
Yeah, somehow. Yeah, exactly. That would probably be the main thing.
Right.
But so then with the film that he made that accompanied it, he and his wife both worked on it, as well as some other people, you know, just to help edit and film. But it's about 32 minutes, and he starts with talking about natural history and, you know, showing images of dinosaurs and old mappings of what the I'm not going to have the correct, like, geological terminology, I think, but
it's fine. But not a geology podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Like Gondwanaland, I think, back from billions of years ago, when the earth, before the land like broke up into the seven continents that we know today, and there was like one larger landmass and stuff. So kind of just tracing, you know, the history of the land and the earth. Throwing it back to my last episode where we were talking about deep time, Smithson isn't directly saying, oh, this is, you know, deep time, but this is that idea that he's engaging with.
Right.
And bringing that up as the premise of Spiral Jetty, and kind of implicitly saying that he is wanting to insert the Spiral Jetty into this lineage of the changing land and deep time.
Yeah.
And so he documents the actual, I guess you could say, building of Spiral Jetty. So he had to contract out people to actually move the boulders, because you can't move 7,000 tons of basalt by yourself.
That, you know, that would be a challenging feat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Challenging is putting it lightly.
Yeah. So you can see the machinery moving the basalt. And one thing that I really enjoy is the way that the sound editing was done. He'll have the machinery with its loud noises moving the rocks over the dirt that it has previously laid. And then it remains on that shot of the forklifts moving the basalt and driving over the dirt, and then it'll just cut, the sound will cut to just waves lapping up on the shore, just so calm and peaceful, and then it'll just cut back to the loud whirring of the machine, and
that's an interesting contrast.
Yeah, I really like that back and forth.
Yeah, and is this film, well, it's 30 minutes, but is this film available like online, or is it easily accessible?
Yeah, so we can put that in the list. Tree? Yes, because it is on a website called UbuWeb, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've used that in our classes for a lot of art films.
Yes, I was going to say, it has tons and tons and tons of video and film from so many artists. It's usually, you know, not like movie directors, it's more of artists,
artists themselves
are doing work in video or in film. But it's a really cool resource, and it also has kind of like sister sites. So they've like,
okay,
where you, if you wanted like sound recordings, like I remember for another paper I wrote, I found a recording of like a conference in New York from like the 1940s with the filmmaker Maya Deren and some other people, which was really cool. Yeah. So it's really interesting. So definitely something to check out. But yeah, so that film is on there, which is where I just rewatched it.
Great.
And then it also, so after you see the spiral being actually created, there are shots taken from probably a helicopter with Smithson's voiceover, and it is just, it's following the spiral in the air. So you're just, you're in the helicopter and you're looking down at the spiral, and the helicopter is just, I mean, it's just going in circles, basically, as Smithson, as Smithson just reads, like, north by northeast, materials, rock, salt, water, minerals, and I don't think that's the exact list. I might be forgetting something, but he basically does that for every direction, where it's like, north by northwest, blah, 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 blah. Northwest.
And he just repeats this as the helicopter is going in circles?
Oh, yes. It is dizzying. And he does, yeah. I mean, he I think he says probably at least like 16 different combinations of things.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But so that even, you're seeing the spiral that he made, the spiral jetty, and then the film itself is spiraling. So,
but yeah, there you go.
There's a lot of spirals.
A lot of spirals.
Yeah.
All in one.
Yes. Spiraling on top of itself. And I should say that throughout the whole film, Smithson is narrating it. So
okay.
I feel like even in the first part of the film, before it gets to the actual earthwork itself in the spiraling in the helicopter, mm-hmm. some of what he is reading and narrating, it you can tell that he is very interested in literature and in writing and poetics, like I have previously mentioned. But
yeah,
it's really interesting. I think it's a very engaging film, you know, for something that is like an art film or in video, like video mm-hmm. art. It definitely is really cool.
Nice. I'll have to check it out myself.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that's a good basis for both the earthwork of Spiral Jetty and for the film.
Mm-hmm.
I do just want to say that Smithson does have a lot of other interesting works that don't get talked about quite as much because Spiral Jetty is just such like this big thing. And so another one that I do want to mention very briefly that I think other people should look up in case they're interested about or interested in learning more about Smithson.
Yeah, and we can share a picture.
Yeah, is his Monuments to Passaic series in which he went to his hometown of Passaic in New Jersey and he took pictures of just what you would think are just ordinary sites just around the city. And he wrote another essay.
A far cry from Spiral Jetty.
Yes. And he wrote another essay about it, writing about his journey to traveling back to Passaic from New York and about why he chose the specific sites. And it's a really nice read as well. Again, very literary and
interesting.
Yeah, and so we can link all of these essays that I've mentioned, because I think I've mentioned three at least now, the non-sites, the mirror displacements, and now the Monuments of Passaic.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that is a good primer for Smithson, and I hope everyone understands a little bit more of why I am so interested by him. So, yeah, thank you all for listening.
That was awesome. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, of course.
I knew practically nothing about him before. The only memory I have of him, we can probably post a picture of this on our Instagram story because it's really cute. But when we went to Denmark and we went to one of the museums, one of his works was in there.
Oh, yeah.
And you got so excited, and I took pictures of you taking pictures because you were so excited. So
yes.
We'll post those on our social media as well.
Yeah. I, you know, so much of his work is not in the gallery. Well, not so much. He does have a number of works that are in the museum and stuff, but I just, I just was not expecting to see it, especially not in Denmark.
Right. It's always the ones you least expect that just excite you the most, I think, in a museum.
Exactly. So, Maria, do you know who you're talking about for the next episode?
Yes. I'm so excited about this. This is literally, I've been waiting this entire episode to say this. So in 2 weeks, we will be having an episode on the Lebanese-American photographer Rania Matar. And what makes this episode extra special is that she is actually going to be joining us for this episode, and we will be interviewing her. And this has been a couple months in the making, so just a back and forth emails with her. So I'm very happy that it's finally happening. And I cannot wait for all of you to hear more about her from her perspective. She has so much going on right now and so many upcoming projects, so I'm really excited. I love her. She's been a huge part of my journey as I've been in the U.S., so yeah.
Oh yeah,
that's my spiel.
This will be really cool. I'm so excited. Like, this is gonna be really fun.
Yeah, I'm excited for you to get to know her as well. I mean, I haven't spoken to her apart from emails yet, so I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm really looking forward to you meeting her as well. Yeah. And everyone else. So yeah, that concludes the episode.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jordan, again.
Yes, thank you, and thank everyone for tuning in.
Mm-hmm. We'll see you next time.
Yeah.
With Rania Matar.
Yeah. Take care. Bye, everyone.
Bye.